Hello, welcome to another episode of GDPR Now, a podcast dedicated to all things related to data security and data privacy, brought to you by Data Protection for Business, and this is DPO. Your host today is me, Karen Heaton, owner of Data Protection for Business, recording from my home office in Southwest London. This episode is part of our series of updated podcasts addressing security and privacy concerns resulting from the coronavirus pandemic and the shift in working practices for millions of businesses across the UK and the world. In this episode, we're going to talk about track and trace apps, the views from Australia. So across the airwaves from Sydney, Australia, we are delighted to have Catherine Sainty and Belindi Rowe from Sainty Law. Sainty Law is a boutique law firm specialising in privacy, big data, technology, cybersecurity, and a range of other specialisations. So delighted to have you on the show today. Catherine, can you tell us a little bit about the firm and why you started it?
Thanks very much, Karen. It's lovely to be with you today. Thank you for inviting us to speak. Sainty Law was founded in 2007. We are a firm which specialises in a consultancy style of practice, where we look at advising clients on a range of issues that help them with their businesses. My expertise was in technology, communications and media, and privacy around that time was a newish field. My vision was to ensure that we could offer clients a service that covered the whole of those converging technologies in a way that produced really good business outcomes. So my passions are actually making clients' businesses work better. And the opportunities to do that have increased enormously in this rather time of upheaval with the COVID-19 pandemic.
It has. It's been an incredible time. Businesses have had to do things that they've never had to contemplate before. It's been quite unprecedented. That's great. Thank you, Catherine. So, Belindi, can you tell us a little bit about your time at the firm and the sorts of clients that you get involved with?
I can. Thanks. Thanks for having us, Karen. I've been at Sainty Law for nearly 2.5 years now. Similar to Catherine, I have a background in IP data and some Commonwealth contracting. At Sainty Law, we work with tech-savvy clients and we help to drive their businesses using data. For example, some of the work that we've recently been involved with is helping broadcasters who collect audience segments to improve viewer experiences. We work with energy disruptors who create marketplaces for trading energy use data. And recently, we've been doing a fair bit of work with health providers. And we help to develop data solutions to improve their public health outcomes. So it's always broad and interesting work at Sainty Law.
Broad and interesting and very current. And obviously with the big changes in the privacy regulations, that mixing of technology, data and privacy comes together very nicely.
It does.
Which quite nicely brings us on to our topic of today, which is track and trace apps. We're really pleased to be able to hear and understand what is happening in Australia around this subject, because obviously there's much discussion here in the UK and Europe about these apps and how they work. So, Catherine, could you maybe just give us a quick overview of the app test and trace program in Australia and what you're seeing there?
Yes, Karen, I can. It's been a very interesting time. We have had an application called COVID Safe, developed by the Australian government. It was developed to enhance the current contact tracing processes, which were manual, as with most places. And the app's based on the Singaporean contract tracing technology. It operates by identifying people who may have come into contact with somebody who's tested positive to COVID-19. So appropriate advice about testing and isolating can be provided to that purpose. The purpose is to identify and isolate. So you can minimise the number of people becoming sick and infecting others, minimise the mortality rate, manage the demand on the health system, and help individuals manage their own risk and their community's risk.
Okay. And on what regulatory basis has the Australian government brought this in?
Well, What happened was that because the pandemic was developing so fast, the time frame around the development of an app was tight. And given our location in Asia, effectively, we had strong influence from what other countries such as Singapore, Taiwan, and South Korea did, so that mm-hmm. there was a real sense of the benefit that a contract tracing app could have, provided that you got it out there disseminated quickly enough. If you think about the timeline, Australia shut down in late March and the app was launched in late April, which is pretty impressive.
That is impressive, yeah.
The Commonwealth did the right thing in developing the app. It also had commissioned an independent third party to run a privacy impact assessment on the app because of the anticipated concern that the population here might have about government collecting data.
Who was the third party to set of interest?
It was a law firm called Maddox. Okay. Yeah. And that's mm-hmm. interesting because it's sort of, I think, the combination of a law firm that does a lot of it is a law firm that does a lot of government work and also has a strong technology background.
Yeah. Okay.
So the PIA recommended quite a lot of changes in the way in which the data was collected and used. And the PIA was publicly released around about the same time as the app. So Australians Right. could read the report, including the recommendations, and the government's response to those recommendations before making the decision to download the app.
Do you think the Australian government was able to learn anything about that process from Singapore and Taiwan, for example? Do you think there was some additional learnings that they were able to get because of their geographical proximity?
Oh, inevitably, I think that that played a really big part. I think that the technology that our app was based on is actually the same as the Singaporean technology. So you had a real head start.
Right, okay.
But to insert it into a different cultural environment where, unlike Singapore, Australians have to be persuaded to take up the app. In Singapore, right. it's a requirement. And we'll come to in a minute the nature of the legislation around the app, because that quite interestingly shows another difference between the Asian countries and ourselves in terms of the requirement to use it. It's totally voluntary to take right. up the app, whereas okay. in those countries it's not.
It's really interesting. And am I right in saying that in Australia that health is organised at the state level, but the app is being rolled out at the federal level?
Yes. Therein lie lots of problems.
And I think similar here, because in the UK we have devolved health to the regions. So in Scotland, Northern Ireland, Wales and England, they have they manage their own health services. But obviously in the same way, the app is coming from central government. So it's interesting. You've got some future issues that we can perhaps learn from here.
Yeah. Well, look, let me just quickly explain the legislative background for the app and how that works, because that's at the Commonwealth level or the federal level. And then Bell can take us through how the app actually works, which draws out some of the practical difficulties that you have in a federal system. So
yep, brilliant.
In terms of the legislative regime, the first thing that happened was that the Minister for Health, Federal Minister for Health, made a determination under a piece of legislation called the Biosecurity Act. And that's an emergency powers type of legislation. And the determination was for the purposes of providing interim privacy protection for information collected voluntarily through the app. And the determination was effectively temporary. And that allowed the minister to make the determination rather than the issue to have to go to Parliament, because here Parliament had stood down for right. a period, and so that mm-hmm. this made it much easier for a fairly executive action. Then in May, the Privacy Amendment Act was passed, it basically had about a week of visibility to the public. It was effectively bringing the operation of the COVID Safe app under the privacy legislation, so that the
operations of it. That's interesting. Yeah.
The usual regime that people are familiar with, the APPs and the other requirements, were able to be drawn on, and the app legislation both amended the Commonwealth Privacy Act but incorporated privacy protection specifically relating to the use of the COVID app. Some of those were, and most interestingly, that the app is voluntary. You cannot require an individual to download, use or upload data through the app. So it's an offence to make a person, for instance, an employer, to refuse to allow an employee to enter into the building if they haven't downloaded the app.
You said it's an offence for an employer to refuse to allow an employee into the building.
It's an offence to make it a condition that they the app to enter. Yeah. So if, for instance, the employer said, I'll let you all come back to work provided that you've downloaded the app, because we really want to make sure that the building is safe and your fellow employees are safe. You cannot do that. You have to say, we recommend that you download the app. It would be a really good thing that you download the app, but to push it further and make it conditional or a requirement is prohibited.
And what about asking employees if they've had symptoms, recording that, taking their temperatures, et cetera, are they allowed to do that?
At this stage, that is all voluntary, and it hasn't really become an issue for employers and employees, because until this week, there was virtually no offices open. Right, because our restrictions on gathering were such that you couldn't have any more than a few people in a fairly large space. And so those issues around people voluntarily being tested or not being tested, wishing to go to work or wishing to stay home, those are issues that we've yet to confront. As the restrictions become lessened, I think that they will become very topical.
Well, it'll be interesting to follow that and see how that develops, actually. Yeah. So thank you for explaining that, Catherine. Belindi, I think you are going to be able to tell us a little bit more about the app itself. I think that'd be useful to know, to understand.
Yeah, sure. The design of the app is pretty interesting. It's of course, it's intended to help with the process of contract tracing that's already happening. So if someone is diagnosed with COVID, the idea is that you would probably want to be able to go back and see who they've been in close contact with, just in case the people that they've been in contact with also need to be tested or they need to isolate themselves. So the app will hopefully speed up that process and provide a tool for eliminating the gap in people's memories about who they've been around when they're asked to recount exactly who they've been in contact with while contagious.
So what are they tracking? What information are they tracking to work out who they've been in contact with?
Yeah, so to do this, the app collects data. And when you first sign up to the app, you're asked to register your name, but you don't have to give your real name. You can use a fake name if you want. And you also enter your phone number and your age range and your postcode. And the information such as age range and postcode are used to do things like to ascertain a particular area where there might be a hotspot of cases coming up, or the age range might help authorities understand what level of risk you are falling into. So the app works by creating an encrypted code, which is shared over Bluetooth with other people who have also downloaded the app on their phone, and the people who can be considered a close contact. And a close contact for the purposes of the app is someone that you have been within 1.5 meters of for about 15 minutes or more. So the app is not going to talk over Bluetooth to everyone that you walk past. You have to have been in contact for 15 minutes.
So that's quite interesting. They've set it at 15 minutes. I don't know, is there some, well, you might not know the answer, I don't know, some scientific determination that says it has to be 15 minutes? Because that's quite a long time, actually. You know, if you can consider if you're in a shop buying, I don't know, an ice cream or a coffee or something, you might only be in there for 5 minutes. Yet
yeah, it is
close to people. It's really, yeah, it's interesting.
It is quite long. I'm not aware of any. It's obviously based on medical advice, but I'm not mm-hmm. aware of any analysis that's actually been undertaken about how well these types of apps are working and whether that 15-minute time frame is working well.
If I can interrupt here, I think partly it's a balancing act between the ability to collect enough information and the ability to collect too much, so that if it were 7 minutes, for instance, you might end up collecting more that was less useful, and the job that you have in terms of the tracing then becomes a broader job with a declining hit rate, if you like.
Yes.
So I think I think that there is no great science, but I think it's more a balancing act.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And then all of the IDs that are collected and stored on the app are encrypted, and they're stored on the app for 21 days before being deleted. However, if before that, those 21 days are up, if you're diagnosed with COVID, then at that point, health authorities will ask if you have the app. And if you do have the app, they'll ask if you are willing to share the IDs that have been collected by your app. So at that point, there's another permission where you would give your consent to say, yes, I'm happy for those IDs to be uploaded to the central government server, which is being called the National COVID Safe Data Store. And those IDs may be used by authorities to contact the people that you've been in close contact with.
Okay, so all the data has been stored locally on the device and they're only uploaded when the user gives consent to the authorities.
So there's two
levels. I think that's different
from
the way we're trying to do it here.
Yeah. So there's two levels of consent. So there's consent when you hand over your information, when you register, which is that, you know, name, phone number, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And then there's a second consent that you're asked for at the point where you've been diagnosed and you're giving consent to upload the data that's stored in the app.
Okay. So first of all, I guess just to summarise from what I've heard then, it's voluntary. Employers can't mandate that employees have the app. And then even when people register, and sadly, if they contract the disease, they've then got to consent again before they give the authorities the information that's been captured on the app. So I think it would be perhaps great to speak to you again in about 6 months' time to see how the app is working. I don't know what percentage of the population need to adopt one of these apps in order to make them effective, but I've heard the number of 60% being used widely, and so it will be really informative to know what percentage of the Australian population are going to be downloading the app and using it.
So, Karen, the numbers that we've got so far are not terribly helpful. The parliamentarians were saying that it needed to be 40% of smartphone users who downloaded the app. We know that there's approximately 6 million, more than 6 million people who have downloaded the app at the end of May. We don't know whether or not people have disabled the app or kept the app operating. So there's a dearth of data about the uptake. And the problem is that there's only one reported case of the app having been used so far. So I think we are very much in the early phase, and we think about it sort of in our own area. We think about it as being, I think, sort of an app that is going to be more valuable in any second wave or third wave, rather than in the place that Australia finds itself now, because here we have limited cases. We're very, very lucky. We have limited cases. But as the population returns to normal living and people go to school and go to work and go out socialising, there is more opportunity for contact, and therefore the track and trace necessity will probably come into
increase,
play.
Perhaps.
Yeah.
Well, that's true, isn't it? Because you're right, you don't have many cases. And, you know, from a behavioural perspective, individuals might think, well, you know, it's hardly present here. Why do I need to bother? But, you know, 6 million downloads is quite a lot for the population of Australia.
Yes, it is. So that's kind of...
that's encouraging.
Yeah, very encouraging. But unfortunately, what isn't so encouraging is there's no metrics of success that have been announced yet. So we're not really sure what success looks like, other than obviously no spread of the disease. I think it'll all evolve.
I think it will. And I think your point was well made in that we're in the first phase, and we're actually preparing ground now in the UK and Australia for future infections, whether it's COVID-19 or any others, because we've never done this before. So it's a big cultural shift for us. Mm. Whereas other countries like Taiwan, Singapore, you know, they've got heads, and China, they've obviously got a head start. They've done this before. Mm. So that's great. That's really interesting. Thank you both. Unfortunately, that brings us to the end of this episode of GDPR Now. Catherine and Belindi, if our listeners want to contact you, I'm going to add your contact details to the show notes. But do either of you have any final words for the listeners?
Oh, look, my only final comment would be to say that, firstly, thank you for the opportunity to be involved with this series, and we look forward to the rest of the Track and Trace series. I think it's incredibly valuable to hear what's going on in other jurisdictions, because it helps us do the cross-pollination of ideas and solutions. And from that point of view, to the extent that any of your listeners are interested in what's happening here, they just have to reach out, and we'd be very happy to share any information that we have that might be of help to them.
Of course. And Belindi?
No, the only thing that I would really say is this process has shown us that the public do want information about what's happening to their data. I mean, the government made a really good decision, I think, by releasing the PIA and the source code for this app at the same time as releasing the app. And maybe the general public didn't read the PIA or analyse the source code, but that allowed privacy professionals and IT professionals to do the analysis and contribute to the public conversation about it. And I think that's contributed to the uptake of the app.
So it really is privacy in action, I think. This is when data protection laws come into their own when things like this happen. So it's great examples to be living through. Thank you both very much. To our listeners, if you've any questions or issues you'd like addressed on the show, please contact me. Or if you'd like to appear on the podcast, my email address is info@dpo4business.co.uk. Thanks for listening. Thanks again to Catherine and Belindi for a really interesting conversation. So that's it from me, Karen Heaton. I hope you will join us again soon. Take care. Stay safe.